Hi, everybody. Good evening. Welcome to Evoke Therapy Program's broadcast. Today is March 1st, 2021, Monday. If you're new to this format, this is an open format where family, friends, parents, grandparents, close friends of the family can submit questions at any time. If you are a sibling, for example, and you're under the age of 18, you can submit your questions and I'll answer them. Tell me your age so I know if I'm speaking to a 17-year-old or a 12-year-old. If you're asking a question about a family member, that's also great. And like I always say, if you're asking a question for and in behalf of a family member, if family members are asking you difficult questions about this process for you, you're welcome to submit questions as if it's from them, and I'll do my best to answer the question. Then you can compare it to your own answer. So with that, let's get right into it. We have a couple of pre-submitted questions, and then we can open it up to any questions we have from our live audience this evening. Somebody writes, pre-submitted question, when my child or anyone asks for advice, I ask questions and continue to listen, but then they keep asking me for input. When I do share more than a few sentences, I feel it becomes more about me. First of all, I love the instinct. You know, we talk about it in the 8 tools for transforming relationships and about this idea that we try to avoid advice. I try to avoid advice for my children, even my younger children. I talk about what works for me. Of course, I talk about boundaries and limits when those are relevant to the discussion. But the idea of telling somebody else how they should live their life doesn't occur to me, which is always strange to me, being a therapist and somebody whose experience has decades of experience in psychotherapy and in parent education. My lack of an inclination to give advice, and then I'll be talking to clients and they'll share with me that their loved ones, friends, and others are constantly giving them advice. I talk about this, that the more I think you grow in this process, it doesn't occur to you to give advice. It doesn't make sense. You can talk about what works from your experience. If you attend 12-step meetings, you'll recognize this format. If you have a therapist who like me, believes that they don't know your truth, you'll be familiar with this experience. But not only is it more effective in the short run and the long run to not give advice, to encourage and facilitate change, but it doesn't go toward the fundamental goal of building, of helping somebody discover themselves. See, the expertise, I talk about this all the time. The expertise of the therapist is not in knowing what you should do, but in creating an environment, a context where you can discover what you need to do for yourself. They can ask questions. They can talk about principles. If somebody asks me for advice, I'll ask them, well, tell me what you're thinking. What do you want to accomplish? Here are some ways that might be accomplished. Or if somebody says to me, you know, I want to take my child home after wilderness, I'll say, tell me about your thinking about that. And if I sense that it comes from a place of guilt or fear, then I'll talk about that. I'll say, I'm not sure that will accomplish your overarching goal. If it comes from a place of confidence and love and awareness, then of course that makes a lot of sense. So really, I think the therapist's job or mentor's job, parent's job, isn't to dispense advice, but rather to help people to think about their own processes, to discover their own truth. One of the things that I always talk to my therapist about when I'm supervising a case with her, sharing a case with her, she'll say to me, I think what I find more fascinating about this case, she'll tell me, is why the client doesn't know the answer themselves. We talked about that. I just finished a 4.5-day intensive, Finding You, with a group of 7 individuals, adults. And one of the things that we looked at over and over again is it's really valuable to understand what's getting in the way of you knowing the answers to the questions in your life. Really, really valuable. Because those are the things that we have to do work around: shame, guilt, fear, our attempt to control things. Those are the kinds of things that we have healing to do around, that we have to work through, you know, work to remove from our lives. And once those things are removed, the truth becomes much more accessible. And you're developing a healthier, more complete, more whole self. And I believe that is the goal in therapy, to help people become their most authentic version of themselves. The biggest fear that people have about this process, as I describe it, is that it's going to lead to lawlessness, right? There's no guardrails. If not for should, then why do we do everything? Which makes a lot of sense that people think that way, because most people are taught and brought up in the worlds of should and shouldn't. And most people who understand this work understand that we have to kill the dragon, if you will, of should and shouldn't, to understand who we are. And while it might get messy in the interim or in the transition into this kind of sensibility that I'm talking about, in the long run, you'll operate from a place of love and courage and authenticity and compassion, kindness, sensitivity. That those are the essence of who we are. And it's the fear and the guilt and the shame and the control that we learn later through our traumatic experiences and through the modeling that we're offered. So thank you for your comment. I like your instincts a lot. The next individual writes, Brad, I've listened to your podcast for a long time and I've learned a lot. I feel I should know the answer to the question I'm asking, but I think it would help me to hear you explain this again. How does teaching someone how to feel help them become themselves? Can you give some examples of what it looks like to teach somebody how to feel? Thanks for considering this question and for doing these podcasts. It's a great question, because some of the stuff, for those of you that are new, you'll recognize this early on, and it can be quite frustrating, is I speak from a fairly abstract place and I tell stories. And again, the reason I do that is because I'm trying to show you what it looks like. Because I can't, like I was just saying to the last question, I can't tell you what to do. So teaching somebody how to feel is, watch the movie about Mr. Rogers. That's the simplest answer. Watch the movie starring Tom Hanks about Mr. Rogers, or the documentary that came out at almost exactly the same time. One is called Malia, A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood. And one is called, Will You Be My Neighbor? I'm not sure what they're called. Maybe you can look them up and post them in just a second. But he does a remarkable job at it. A child is experiencing fear or anger or frustration, and he empathizes. He listens. He validates. He seeks to understand their story in the context of their emotions. In other words, he's helping them to be what is. I read an article one time about somebody talking about Mr. Rogers, and they had made an interpretation of how Mr. Rogers might respond to somebody. And the critic in this article I was reading said, Mr. Rogers would have never told a child how to feel, would have never told a child that they had to move through, get rid of, and overcome their anger or fear or whatever the feeling was in this example that they were offering. Mr. Rogers would allow them to feel it. We fear that if we allow people to feel, that they'll get stuck and lost in it, when it's exactly the opposite. When we allow people to feel, when we sit with them, empathize, show compassion, become curious. Always think about replacing curiosity with your initial kind of triggered response. When we get curious about it, that the person can move through it. It's when we, as a friend or a parent or a mentor or a colleague, it's when we get invested in the person not feeling what they're feeling. Sometimes that comes out overtly, and sometimes it comes out much more subtly. When we get invested, when we have an agenda in somebody feeling a certain thing or not feeling a certain thing, that is what contributes to them getting stuck. So you do it by listening. You do it by empathizing. And then the person develops a whole idea of themselves, and they don't get fixated and stuck. They don't develop neuroses and mental health issues, because mental health is a defense, right, against feeling uncomfortable or unpleasant feelings. So when your child comes to our program, or when you come to our program, We ask you how you feel over and over again, and we sit and we listen and we understand. Like I talk about in The Audacity to Be You, we say to you, you must have a good reason for feeling this. I want to understand more. So you're just teaching somebody what they are. Mr. Rogers and Malia has posted this on here. A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood is the one with Tom Hanks. And Won't You Be My Neighbor is the documentary. Lovely, almost perfect examples of what healthy therapy and healthy parenting and healthy friendship looks like. I would watch them in either order. I watched the motion picture first and then the documentary. I probably would recommend it that way because the documentary's, I think, a little bit more pure. It's really Fred Rogers. So somebody asked this next question. How do I move from I feel statements where when my teen engages in unhealthy behavior and transition into holding her accountable for her for the choices? How do I help her leave the conversation knowing that what she has done is not okay, but feeling hope? The first thing I want to say, I say this in The Audacity to Be You, and I've said this over the past 5 or 6 years. I think we use I feel statements inappropriately. I think we often use I feel statements as a way to manage behavior. And that's the way I started off my parenting, and I still do sometimes today when I slip or regress. That's the way my parents taught me. I ask most parents across the world about their parenting approach, and most of them think that you tell the child when you're upset, when you're sad, when you're frustrated, disappointed, angry, scared. And those expressions, even those I feel statements, are supposed to teach or be an indication to the child of when they are off or on course. The problem with that is then the child becomes wired, hardwired, to believe that what somebody else feels is about them. So when they go out in the world and try to differentiate and they interact with peers, what peers think about them weighs on them very heavily. In other words, we wire our children when we parent them with I feel statements to try to modify behavior. We wire them to not know themselves. We wire them against mental health inadvertently. We don't know this. I wish this was more universally known or taught. It's obvious as can be to anybody that thinks about it, even most parents that I teach. So I feel statements are a way to get things off your chest. They're a way to own your stuff. Really, it's about owning your stuff. This is my feeling. It's not about you. It's the boundaries that do the teaching for children. Here's the limit. Here's what you're allowed to do. Here's what I'm not okay with. Here's what I am okay with. Here's what I'm not okay with. If you do this, this is going to be the response. If you don't do this, this is going to be the response. And so the I feel statements should be limited and virtually should never be about getting the child to think that they've done well or poorly, right or wrong. Because then they will believe when their boyfriend or girlfriend or their peer says they're sad that they're not coming out and partying with them, or they're bummed. It's more subtle than that, of course. Or somebody wants to have sex with them and they're saying, well, I don't want to, but my boyfriend seems to be hurting because of it. Or they end up in a toxic relationship and they're unable to leave it because the person tells them that if they leave, they're abandoning them, they're a failure, something's wrong with them, right? They're pre-wired by us to believe that that's true and that's about them. So it's the boundaries. The I feel statement should be pretty limited. There's a picture in The Journey of the Heroic Parent, a cartoon that I borrowed from somewhere, about parents and they're holding a child psychiatry book behind their back because they've learned the I feel statement, of course. And they come into Johnny's room, Junior's room, and they say to Junior, you know, it makes mommy and daddy very upset when you tie your babysitter and throw all the furniture out the window, something like that. And the idea that I think in our educated world, we think that that's good parenting. Good parenting is not unloading your feelings onto the child so they feel responsible for changing. If you share your feelings, it's because you're owning it. It's about you. And I try to share it very, very judiciously with my children. Do we have more? There we go. Someone writes, our 14-year-old son is in wilderness. We are in the process of selecting a therapeutic boarding school for aftercare. How much should we or can we rely on his Evoke therapist to help us make a good decision? We love our son's therapist and really want his guidance. He knows our son very well. He also knows the therapeutic boarding school very well. We jokingly tell him he should make the decision for us. I've been told that before. Ideally, we ask all of you to hire a consultant if you haven't. I don't know if the consultant has made that recommendation. The consultants are tasked with the responsibility of knowing schools and programs and personnel and populations. But definitely your therapist can weigh in on what they think is a good fit, what aspects your child needs, what features of a program are good. But ultimately, here's the facts. It's not going to be perfect. Your child's going to complain that it's not the right place and that these aren't the right peers and that they could come home and show you and do it better. Virtually all of you are going to get some pushback, some letter, some phone call like that in the first couple of months. There's going to be a mistake and a drop ball. And so you kind of have to own it, because if you defer, abdicate too much of the choice onto somebody else, it's more likely you'll feel resentful. So you make the best guess that you can. And then I say this all the time, you turn it over to the child. Make a discerning choice based on the information you have. Ask your wilderness therapist, your educational consultant, or if you have another referring professional that knows programs that you're working with at home, work with them. But ultimately, you make the best guess that you can, and then you turn it over to the child. The children say to me over the years that the ones who make the most progress, they say that the most important characteristic in the next program that will lead to my success is me, is the characteristics in me. So it's a very, as I always say, I encourage you to be a discerning consumer, to ask tough questions and expect smart answers. Absolutely. And, you know, talk to people that you trust, your own therapist, your consultant, whomever it is in your life that you trust, to work through any concerns or problems you have about it. So if there's a concern, you have somebody, a sounding board to kind of work it through. Is this about you? A blind spot in your awareness, your psychoeducation? Or is this about the therapist of the program and where they're falling short? That's another aspect that a referring professional or educational consultant can offer you in this process. So it's a tough choice. I do have a podcast webinar on, Malia, maybe you can pull up the link for both those. I have one on how to choose the best fit aftercare for your child. So I would also recommend or refer you to that as something to listen to or watch. So somebody says, so if we don't start the conversation with an I feel statement after she does unhealthy choices, what is the best way to have a conversation? Get questions that are curious. Tell me about it. Tell me about what was going on. How are you feeling? You know, I think it's questions that come out of learning. Remember this. This is important for mental health. Everything everybody does is their best attempt to deal with the dilemma of living. The dumbest, most unhealthy, most ridiculous behavior makes sense in a certain context. Our job as parents and therapists is to understand that context. I remember when I asked my son many years, you know, 20 years ago almost, I'd gotten some feedback from the neighbors that he was picking on a smaller boy in the neighborhood with some learning differences. And as you might imagine, I was furious, embarrassed, right? Angry, frustrated, so many feelings. So I, you know, when my son came home, I confronted him on it. I was full of rage. I would have been so much wiser to take a time out. But I was young, he was young, and I didn't know what I was doing. And I said to him, why did you pick on this boy? Is it because it made you feel better? And with my anger and my size and his smallness, he was probably about 11 years old at the time, maybe 12. He was shaking, but I was too out of anger. And he paused thoughtfully and he said, yes, I guess it does. And then I got more angry. He'd actually told me the truth, the exact thing that I'd suspected. But what I realized in looking back on that, you know, hours later, days later, and of course, decades later, is I was just mad and embarrassed. And that wasn't his fault or his responsibility. And then I shamed him and I punished him and I tried to threaten him and scare him back into compliance, right? That's a more extreme example of things, but that also is a template for kind of our worst instincts in parenting. It's not our child's job to make us happy. I mean, I can't think of anything more simple than that. It's not our job, our child's job. In Al-Anon, the way they say it is, your serenity or your peace of mind is your responsibility. And the adage that you're only as happy as your least happy child is crazy. It places a large burden on the child. And for those of you who have severely children that are struggling with severe issues, you have to come to terms with that. You can kind of get away with that when it's just the worried well, as we say in therapy. But when situations get dire and severe and chronic, you end up realizing, I have to find my serenity somewhere else. It's not my child's job to care. They can't do it. Somebody writes, piggybacking on the I feel statements, my son recently said, stop talking like a therapist and speak normally. He is really resisting the communication model. Part of this must come because I'm clunky at it, but how do you recommend addressing the strong dislike for my new communication style? Again, let me I'll say two things. I'll answer your question. I want to be clear. I'm close to discouraging parents from ever using an I feel statement with their child. Okay? I'm almost there. And if you want to read more about that in The Audacity to Be You, I explain it clearly. It weighs too heavily on the child. It's not the purpose of the I feel statement. So first of all, you know, I learned this a long time ago that when my children don't like my therapeutic approach to parenting, my response is, okay, I can't not be me. But he might be resisting. I think he's resisting the underlying energy that you're trying to control him emotionally. I had one parent, I told this story. I was at a parent meeting many, many years ago, 10, 15 years ago. And this parent talked about their son coming home. It was a Saturday. The young adult, he might've been 18. The young adult son had agreed to help the parent move and then at the last minute had bailed out. And then the parent basically gave an I feel statement to the son. And everybody applauded the parent for doing it the right way. And the son wasn't present when this story was being told, but the parent told us that the son accused the parents of guilting him. And everybody's like, oh, you did the I feel statement perfectly. And I said, why did you share the I feel statement? And eventually we got down to, she did want the son to feel guilty for breaking his commitment to help them move something from the office or whatever the task was on that Saturday. And that the son was right. So the problem is we use guilt in parenting. And so your feelings are your responsibility, not your child's. Remember, the purpose of the I feel statement, it's funny because it's not even to communicate as much as it is to be aware of what's going on inside of you. When I share feelings with my children, I try to say, front loaded with, this is not about you. I'm only telling you this because it's coming up for me. I try never to use I feel statements in parenting to get my child to do something different. I use boundaries, limits, consequences, requests for that. So I think he might be resisting something. I had a parent say to me some years ago also, Brad, I did everything right. I listened to my daughter. I used the communication skills model. I listened perfectly, and she still is angry with me. And I said, do you hear it? And he looked at me strangely and said, I don't know what you're talking about. And I said, you still had the agenda for her not to feel what she was feeling. And she could probably sense that from your listening. In both books, my The Journey of the Heroic Parent and The Audacity to Be You, I say, if you use communication skills to try to change a child, you're getting it backwards. You're getting it off. You give your I feel statements mostly to your partner, your co-parent, your therapist, your friend that you can vent to. But our children can't carry our emotions. They do very, very poorly under the weight of our disappointment. I've said this. This is going to sound crazy to new people. I know it does because it sounded crazy to me. And I've had people tell me it 100 times. I try to not tell my children I'm proud of them because it doesn't matter what I think. I don't want them to live according to my value system. I want them to find their own. I don't live according to my mother's value system or my father's. I, Brad Reedy, do not. I don't vote for the same candidates as my mother. I don't go to the same church on Sunday that my mother goes to. So I try not to be proud of them or to experience that because I also don't want to be disappointed. It's like the story I tell about Bob Dylan. When a reporter asked him in 1990 if he was proud of his son's success because his son had a number one album, Bob Dylan said, it's irrelevant. Makes no difference to me. And I thought he was being crazy or weird, but what he was saying is, my love for my son is not based on his accomplishments, his successes, even his choices. So the most important thing I would say is I feel statements are not often for you to your children, unless you're trying to own something, unless you're trying to get clear and watch and pay attention to how heavily they take those on. Thank you for posting all those links, Malia. That's great. Somebody says, how do you make the transition for your child coming home after attending a program? How do you make the transition for your child coming home after attending a program? Malia, we have a podcast webinar on coming home that you can list here where I talk about it for an hour. Thank you. That's quick. You do your work. There's a quote somebody shared with me today about Mr. Rogers, unrelated to my love for the man. By the way, when I was a kid, I couldn't stand him. I thought he was weird, creepy, patronizing. Maybe I didn't hear him at the right time. And it also could have been because my family context wasn't that gentle and soft as he was. So it wasn't a good match for me. Now I think he was a genius. I think he's a national treasure. I think he's the best example of a non-formally trained therapist I've ever heard speak in my life. Mr. Rogers said, he was interviewed by Oprah Winfrey. You can Google this. Mr. Rogers said, when Oprah Winfrey asked, she said, what's the biggest mistake that parents make? And Mr. Rogers said, I think that parents forget what it was like to be a child. And so you do your work. I mean, that's the answer to most questions. You do your work. I've said this before. We know two things. We know two things for sure. When I say we know them for sure, we know them because the research tells us and our practice also supports this. We know that a healthy, secure attachment where a child feels safe and welcomed as they are is the number one contribution to a child's mental health and resilience. Healthy attachment, secure attachment is the number one contribution we make to a child and their mental health. The second thing we know is that the ability of a parent to provide a secure attachment, a healthy attachment, is based on how well the parent has made sense out of their own childhood. Not how good the parent's childhood was. That's not an indicator and doesn't correlate. But how well the parent understands their own childhood is the best predictor of the parent's ability. So do your work. Try Al-Anon. We ask you to go to 6 meetings of Al-Anon, Code of Families Anonymous, or Adult Children of Alcoholics. Listen to podcasts, read books. Listen long enough so that you understand the thinking. And by the way, this isn't my thinking. This is attachment theory-informed therapy. Okay? That's what my books and podcasts are about. So listen long enough that you learn how to think. That's what I've done. I mean, what I'm teaching you comes from my work and from listening to somebody who shared this sensibility with me over the course of 20 plus years. Oh, somebody asked, what do I mean worried well? It means very low on the symptomatic scale. Your average anxious person. Somebody that doesn't qualify for a mental health diagnosis. A lot of therapists want to treat the worried well, not people with legitimate diagnosable issues. Somebody says, do you feel relational therapy is more enduring than behavioral? I mean, behavioral therapy has its place, but I believe that the therapist relationship supersedes all therapeutic models. And as my professors taught me over and over again, every therapeutic approach works equally well. Every therapeutic approach has research to support it. But what I teach our therapists at Evoke is you can use DBT, you can use cognitive behavioral, you can use ACT, you can use brain spotting, EMDR, somatic experiencing. I mean, the list goes on. You can use any of those theories and models. Those are all helpful. Family systems theory, internal family systems, all those models you can use. But if the relationship between the therapist and the client doesn't supersede it, the client isn't going to feel it. So yes, behavioral principles are something we use, but it can't eclipse the client. It can't become bigger than the client. And the problem with behavioral therapy, if used wrongly, if you will, is that we don't pay attention to the child. We reduce them to their behaviors. And children are much bigger than their behaviors. I was recently listening to a lecture on diversity, and somebody was saying, when a young African-American boy presents in therapy with oppositional defiant disorder, that we should take a step back and understand that in the context of his life, that opposition might be opposition to an unfair, unjust system. And my thought was, we always think that. When I see a diagnosis, it doesn't matter the diagnosis. Narcissism, borderline, oppositional defiant. I hear a lot of people say all the time, oppositional defiance is a made-up diagnosis. No, it's not. It's not a made-up diagnosis. It's just a description of symptoms that have developed into a pattern. But the real treasure, the real wisdom is to understand the context and the wound that's underneath it, that these symptoms that are presented in such an organized way that they become a diagnosis, that they make sense. And so behavioral theory is fine, but it ought not to supersede the deep work of understanding the individual's trauma and wound and how it makes sense. Whether it applied to treating an addict, to somebody with a mood disorder, and so forth and so on. Even if the person with a mood disorder needs medication, which we at Evoke support fully, Still, the therapist can't let their theory eclipse or stand in the way of seeing the child or the parent as a person, a whole person. No questions at the moment. I'll go over some slides, and then if any questions come in, I'll address them. My two books, The Journey of the Heroic Parent and The Audacity to Be You, are both out now on Amazon. As I say often, I know that some people aren't a fan of Amazon. And what I tell you is it's helpful for small booksellers like me who might not be in small bookstores. So you can go to Amazon.com for The Journey of the Heroic Parent. Also, the audiobook for The Audacity to Be You is completed. I did it myself by request. We have an in-person, I think we have one spot left in our in-person Finding You intensive. I think we have two spots left in our online intensive. If you want to do a deep dive into your work, your family of origin, this is the place to do it. We have an in-person Finding You 2, May 12th. By the way, I do a couple a year, and I am doing again the one in March, the March 17th through 20th, 21st. March 4th will be our next online support group, and March 9th will be our next online support group for intensive parents. So for Wilderness parents or alumni, March 4th, 6:30 p.m. For alumni of our intensives program, it's March 9th at 6 p.m. Just email malia@evoketherapy.com for more information. We ask all current parents to go to 6 12-step support groups, any combination of Al-Anon, CODA, Families Anonymous, or adult children. You can also go to refugerecovery.org for a Buddhist-inspired support group, and NAMI.org, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, has free resources and a chapter in your local area. Follow us on social media. All of these broadcasts are available on your favorite podcast app. Just search Finding You in Evoke Therapy Podcast, or go to soundcloud.com on your computer. You can find us at Evoke Therapy on Twitter and Instagram, and also at Evoke Therapy Intensives on Instagram. On Facebook, you can find us by searching Evoke Therapy Programs or Evoke Therapy Intensives. And of course, the blog has new content each week. When's my next webinar? Is March 3rd. Is that right? March 3rd at 6:30 p.m. Is that right? Okay. Some questions have come up. Can a young teenager have a defined diagnosis, or is it part of being a teenager? Of course. Yeah, they can. Yeah, there are plenty of diagnoses that are appropriate for those in childhood. And you're very wise to ask it. We need to kind of ferret out what's normal teenage behavior, because it's like the diagnosis becomes this perverted, mutated form of natural development, right? Because they don't know how to find a healthy course to work out the issues of childhood. They become distorted. They mutate into something different. And so our job as therapists and parents is to kind of follow it back and understand what are the core needs being addressed, what's not being met by them, that this diagnosis and these behaviors are meeting. And The Audacity to Be You, I talk about mental health as, you know, a wound or a trauma followed by a behavior to protect the person from uncomfortable or unwanted feelings. And if those behaviors develop into a pattern, then we call that a diagnosis. So triggering event or wound, behavior or symptom or defense, and at the deepest level, or excuse me, at the last level, it becomes a diagnosis because it's a predictable pattern, a style of coping. Somebody says, sorry for the late question. You're not late. You're perfectly fine. Does this ever happen with the therapist at Evoke where they do not feel connected to their client or clients in the group, and they raise this concern to the concerned folks? Does this ever happen? And if so, how do you handle the situation at Evoke? Yes, it happens sometimes. And that's part of what you're doing in supervision, which is mostly what I do. And I have two clinical directors also at each of our sites, three if you count the intensives. They're supposed to provide, if you find yourself angry, disappointed, frustrated, upset, the list can go on, with your client, you have, in a sense, lost contact with them. Henry Wadsworth Longfellow said, If we read the secret history of our enemies, we will find in each man's story suffering sufficient to disarm all hostility. And Abraham Lincoln said, I do not know that man. I want to get to know him. I must get to know him. I do not like that man. I must get to know him. When we understand somebody, it's like what I wrote in the Audacity of You. One of the boys asked me one time, how can you love me if you're getting paid to care about me or love me? And I said to him, I don't get paid to care about you or love you. I get paid to understanding you. And when I understand you or I find you, loving you is easy. It's automatic. So yes, sometimes therapists come feeling disconnected from the parent they're working with or from the client in the field they're working with. And then it's my job to help them get in touch with what's in the way of that. Why are they being triggered? How have they lost contact with that person? So great question. Great questions. That looks like that's all the questions for this evening. Yep. Well, I'll talk to you on Wednesday. It's great talking to you. I hope this is a helpful point of contact. I do the question and answer every other session. This coming Wednesday is chapter 3 of my book, The Journey of the Heroic Parent. So I'll be talking about that this week. Have a great week, folks. I hope this is a helpful point of contact. I'll talk to you in a couple of days. Take care. Bye-bye. Better year you'll be.